The Commentary Track, conversations with film historians and filmmakers. With Frank Thompson.
Hello, and welcome to episode 35 of The Commentary Track. I'm your host, Frank Thompson, that teenage star of tomorrow, and we have a really good one for you today. But before we get started, I wanted to do something that I've been thinking about doing for quite a while, and that is to urge you to go to iTunes and leave a favorable review for me, with any luck, a 5-star rating. But in addition to the 5-star rating, I really like it when people write something nice, and so I thought I would read a couple that are up there right now. Here's a very basic one, and I like it. Frank is smart, funny, and very informative. Great podcast. See? Simple. That's by GG Town. I don't know who most of these people are. They write under a pseudonym of this kind, and some of them I do know, and so I take theirs with a great deal of flattery and gratitude. But for the people who I don't know, I'm even more grateful because I feel like they're strangers listening to this podcast and getting something out of it. Someone named UAIP says, "This is the first podcast of this type that I have found for fans of classic movies. These are the kind of people you want to listen to. Hopefully," I think that's grammatically iffy, "but there are many more episodes to come. Another thing worth noting, the audio quality of these podcasts is very good." Now, I'm glad to hear that, because sometimes the audio quality of these podcasts is somewhat lacking, and I feel ashamed when that happens. So I'm delighted that UAIP likes it, and I hope I continue to improve. TRT96 says, "A very fun, informative podcast that features powerhouse guest historians. I enjoyed every minute, and you will too. Frank has done a wonderful job for classic Hollywood fans." There's lots more like that, and I want you to add your voice to those, because it really does help build an audience if the responses on iTunes are positive and are laudatory like this. And certainly if you don't like the podcast, then why are you even listening to this? Don't go on there and rag on me. I get enough of that in my real life. So if you don't have something nice to say, go say it somewhere else, would you? But if you do have something nice to say, I wish you would go on iTunes and do it. It's cost you nothing and would help me out a great deal. I sometimes ask for people to help the podcast financially, and you can certainly do that by going to the podcast webpage, thecommentarytrack.com, and hit the donate button. And I'm incredibly grateful for that. But I know that times are hard and that a lot of people just cannot afford to go throwing money around at random podcasts. So this is a way you can help me out for free, and it really will help me out a great deal. So I want you to consider doing that, and I thank you for it. Now, on to the interview for today. This is a kind of a companion piece for one that appeared a couple of weeks ago. I recently interviewed Sissy Wellman, who is the third of four daughters of William A. Wellman, a director who I've spent much of my life researching his career and life. All the Wellman progeny that I've met have been delightful and wonderful people, and I had a great time with Sissy. But today I'm talking with her older brother, Bill Jr. William Wellman Jr. was in two of his father's films and also worked with great directors we'll talk about today. I ask him specifically about some John Ford stories, and he's got some good ones, and a lot of good stories about his dad, and a lot of good stories about his own career, and his surprising Star Trek connection, which has won him a completely separate following, and really interesting stuff. He's a great guy. He's written at least two books now on his father. He's got a big biography of his father coming out from Random House pretty soon. Not to be confused with the book that John Gallagher and I are writing on Wellman. They'll be very, very different books, and Bill's will come from a much more personal place, and I will be the first human on earth to buy it, I betcha. And I hope that you will enjoy this great conversation with Bill Wellman Jr. Your family went girl, boy, girl, boy, girl, right?
My father said he knew how to do it.
He did?
He said, yeah, girl, boy, girl, boy, girl, boy, girl. He said, no, I know how to do it. He says, I talked to them in Dottie, you know, in his wife's stomach.
Mm-hmm.
He says, I talk to them. You know, he says, I know how to do this. He used to tell people all the time.
Well, it worked out fine. Because your dad was a director, which I guess is different than being a movie star or something, because were your friends or were your schoolmates aware of him as a director, or was it something that even came up?
Well, to start with, the neighborhood that I grew up in, which was Brentwood in West L.A., my father was one of the first. I think he was the second film person to arrive in that neighborhood. He bought the property in 1935, and only Milton Sills.
Wow.
what do they call him? The Hawk?
he was the Seahawk. Yeah.
Seahawk. Yeah. He had come there first, as far as I know, and he had passed away soon after my father arrived. I think he passed away in the 40s. But so my father bought the property in 35. There was another house on the property, which he knocked down that house and built a new house in 1941. And then all of a sudden, it seemed like the celebrities were just coming in boatloads. As you probably know, originally, all the celebrities, the film people, wanted to stay close to the studios. As the studios were being created, everyone wanted to stay there. And then after a while, they said, well, we want to work here, but we don't want to live here. So they started moving west. And at one point, I think I counted 27 or 28 well-known celebrities living in my neighborhood. So my buddies, the kids that I grew up with in the neighborhood, we thought every neighborhood was like this. Everybody had these celebrities. I mean, we had Tyrone Power and Gary Cooper, Eddie Bracken. We had Van Johnson, Keenan Wynn. We had the Andrew sisters. We had John Payne and Gloria DeHaven. We had Robert Walker, married to Jennifer Jones. We had Lana Turner. We had Nelson Eddy. We had Frank Capra. We had Red Skelton, Peter Lawford, Bob Crosby, Bing Crosby's brother, Xavier Cugat, Irene Dunne, and my favorite, Hopalong Cassidy,
wow.
William Boyd.
Gee.
And my buddies and I, we used to sneak up to his house, and we'd hide in the lot next to his house. We were afraid to go on his property or knock on the door or anything like that. We would just go and hope to see him. And if we were really lucky, we'd see him come driving up the hill in his Cadillac convertible with bull's horns on the front of it. And if we saw that, we'd watch him till he went into the house. Our weekend was made. So, you know, these people were all over the place.
Yeah.
And that's what I grew up with.
It's interesting to me, I mean, because had I lived there, I didn't come from a famous family, and Hopalong Cassidy would have killed me to see him. But it's interesting to me that you lived around so many famous people, and yet you still had a space in your brain for being starstruck about Hopalong Cassidy. You know,
absolutely, and I really have always been starstruck. I have never really gotten over that, and I deem it a good thing because
sure.
It's part of the love that I've had for the film industry, and that can carry you through tough times.
I guess. Well, when did you become aware of your father as a professional person?
Well, I was very lucky. Being that I was the oldest son and one of the oldest kids, my father would take me with him to sets and locations. And if it wasn't during the school year, I stayed for the whole shoot. I think I went on 27 of his films. And some of them, if they were in the summer, I was there the whole shoot. So I was always aware of him, and I always thought he was so fabulous that he could, you know, make movies. Because to me, it was pure magic.
Mm-hmm.
And I used to hang around the Wranglers if it was a Western. I got the run of the place. And I always knew that this was a special thing, and I better not mess up. Because then he won't take me anymore. So I was a good boy. I didn't, you know, most of the time. I was a good boy, and I loved it. So I knew he was important. As a kid, you know, you don't start comparing my father with somebody else. I just thought he was wonderful.
Was there a difference in what you saw on the set and what you saw at home in him?
Yeah, he didn't bring his work home really that much. He used to, you know, grouse about certain things around the dinner table sometimes. Every once in a while, he'd start talking about casting. Or we would bring up the question of, you know, when he was doing a film, well, who's in it? We only cast one person, and that was Sidney Blackmere on The High and the Mighty. That picture was the most difficult to cast of any picture my father made. In terms of originally Spencer Tracy was supposed to play the lead, and at the last minute he dropped out. All of the leading ladies in Hollywood, all the ones that my father had worked with, there was Barbara Stanwyck and Loretta Young and Joan Crawford and Dorothy McGuire and a whole list of them had all rejected him. So he had constant problem. And the last person to cast, well, was John Wayne taking Spencer Tracy. But the next to the last person was Sidney Blackmere. My father, for some reason, was having trouble casting the heavy. And my mother and I and my sister Pat had just seen Sidney Blackmere in a craft theater or one of those live television shows that he had an important role in playing a bad guy. So we said to Dad, "Dad, you got to get Sidney Blackmere. We saw him last night. I mean, he was just great." And my father had used Sidney Blackmere in a very small part in Buffalo Bill, very small. And the next thing you know, he cast him. Now, I don't think Sidney ever knew that we cast him in that picture. So my dad didn't talk a lot about. Now, later, you know, when I got older and was in the business, then we used to talk about it a lot. And he talked a lot at that point about it. But as kids growing up, he was a family man.
Yeah, I've seen that picture of you on the set of Nothing Sacred, but you're... sadly, too young to realize where you were with Carol Lombard.
I wish, you know, it's funny about memory, your memory, because, I mean, I know, you know, I have, there are pictures, I was on the set, Carol Lombard held me in her arms, but I'm 6 months old or something like that. And I have no memory of that. But I do remember her. Her brother used to live on the one street over from us. And sometimes when she visited him, she would come over and visit Dad. And now I'm four or 5 years old, not older than that. She would come over and with the blonde hair and fast talking and just, and she and my father would be having such a good time and telling stories and jokes. And I remember in my father's den, he would sit in his easy chair and she would sit on the couch, a small little couch, and she pulled me up on her lap, you know, and I remember just looking up at her thinking, God, isn't she just wonderful? She's so beautiful. And she's just talking on and on and on. Now, I'm amazed. There are no pictures of that, because a lot of times if there are pictures of it, the event, after a while you begin to think you remember because you've got these pictures. So there are no pictures of this, but I remember that moment.
It should be pretty hard to forget, I would think.
Yeah, but how many things are you going to remember at that age?
Well, that's true.
Not many. No. I don't remember many things at that age.
No, scattered things.
I mean, I remember at the same age when the new house was being built. So this is 1941, 42. And Dad rented a place at Malibu. And one day he said, "Bill, you want to come with me? I'm going to walk down the beach and meet the Lone Ranger." Well, again, how much could I have known about the Lone Ranger at that age? But I did. I went down and I sat there and there was the Lone Ranger talking to my father. And I'm telling you, now this is the Lone Ranger of the
radio
of the early 1940s, Robert Livingston, who had played the Lone Ranger in, I think, one feature.
Oh, in the serials, yeah.
Yeah, in the serials. So... that I remember.
I'm just trying to think. Did Robert Livingston ever work with your dad?
Well, in researching, I have a feeling my father was thinking about him for the Oxbow incident.
Ah.
See, or it could have been Buffalo Bill, one of the two. Because both those pictures were being made around that time. And otherwise, why would he go down and talk to Robert Livingston?
Sure.
So that's my guess.
Well, what movies of his do you remember being on the sets of? I mean, do you actually have memories?
Well, a lot of them. Some of them I just, you know, I remember a few things. But pictures like, Across the Wide Missouri, of course, because the whole family went to Colorado for that shoot. Yellow Sky was another one. And I was the only family member there. My father took me to Lone Pine, California, and I was there for the whole shoot, and I love that. I have so many memories. And up there, they have a Western Museum, so they have a lot of information, a lot of pictures of me on the set of Yellow Sky. Yellow Sky is kind of a signature Western of that, of that town. So I have a lot of memories there, and I remember staying at the old Dow Hotel. Richard Widmark used to take me out for milkshakes after work because he didn't want to go to the bars. I mean, this is, as I got older, I realized, why is he messing around with me? Because, you know, I'm the director's son, so no one's going to treat me badly. But he treated me a lot better than he needed to.
Yeah. Just that he didn't want to drink?
I don't think he wanted to be away from it? I think he wanted to be away from it, and I don't know. We got to talking, and I was around every day, you know. So I got to know him a little bit. And Ann Baxter was also, I had a little crush on her. I used to get the, you know, I'd go on the set, whoever the leading lady was. I remember Maureen O'Hara on Buffalo Bill, and I got pictures sitting in her lap, and they dressed me up as Buffalo Bill Jr. with the mustache and the whole thing, just like Joel McRae.
Yeah.
And I thought she was absolutely gorgeous. So
I think so still.
Yeah. I have many memories of those two films.
Going back to Yellow Sky, I've always been puzzled by something. Maybe you can shed some light on it. Often when your dad was being interviewed in the 60s and 70s, later in his life, whenever that comes up, he's always pretty disparaging about Gregory Peck. And I've never figured that out. Gregory Peck seems like he would be right up your dad's alley. And do you know anything about, did Gregory Peck just make him mad at some point? Or?
Well, this is what I know. My father was not keen on casting Gregory Peck. He was very respectful of Gregory Peck as an actor. And he's certainly a gentleman. But he wanted somebody that had more of an edge, a tougher actor. Say, and he used to always tell this story about he was trying to figure out, how can I make Gregory Peck tough? And he had that fight scene with John Russell in that little water pool, and he had him kick him in the head. And he said after that, everyone knows that this, you don't fool with this character played by Gregory Peck. But Gregory Peck was one of the most, I just think, a full gentleman. Really the epitome of a great actor and a great person. And I worked with him three times in movies. And we used to talk about it. He never said anything bad about my father. But my father always liked to, I don't know what it is, except my father, as you know, Frank, he'd love to say he didn't like actors, but he liked a lot of actors. And he just, you know, and Gregory Peck had broken his ankle before they started shooting Yellow Sky. And if you see that movie, he's running around on those rocks up there in Lone Pine with a broken ankle and never squawking about it. Also, he kind of kept to himself, you know. He wasn't in the bar after work like the rest of the actors, except for Widmark. He was off by himself. He was just kind of a quiet person there. And my father liked, you know, the guy who was part of the gang, you know. could be male or female, but that's what he liked. And a guy who's intellectual, who's kind of off on his own, is not going to be my father's favorite.
Yeah. I remember when we went to Peck's house while making the documentary, Wild Bill, he was just almost worshipful of your dad. I mean, he really just spoke only the most wonderful things about that experience. So,
yeah, well,
I get the feeling that your dad didn't treat him badly on the set or anything like that.
No.
Because Peck didn't seem to have any kind of negative memories of that at
all. No, but he loved, you know, the fight that Peck has with Ann Baxter rolling around in the corral. And he told Ann Baxter, he says, I want you to really rough him up. Because she wasn't really that fond of Gregory Peck either. But it wasn't, she respected him, but she didn't really, you know, I don't know what that is, why that is. But when my father, and he used to tell this story too, where he told her, he says, look, just kick the shit out of him. You know, and she scratched him and beat him up. And he did it without, you know, he never said a thing. It was just part of the scene.
Well, your dad had a long history of doing that, right? Of getting fight scenes realistic, and Wings going to Buddy Rogers and Richard Arnold and saying, you know, that Rogers thinks he can beat you, and I don't think so. But
yeah, I know.
Just setting him up.
He liked to do that. But back to Gregory Peck, I played the PT boat commander in MacArthur, and for about a week, they shot all these scenes out they were out in Catalina on the isthmus side of Catalina. And it's just really Gregory Peck and me up in the conning tower of this PT boat. And there's a lot of downtime when they were moving the camera boat to get in position or bringing the camera equipment on board. And he talked about my father glowingly. And they never had any social life together, you know. But he was just, you know, he appreciated my father as a director. That's what it was.
Yeah.
And he used to say, told me a number of times that he wished that they would have made more pictures together. So, what are you going to say?
Well, they made a real good one together. Yeah. I think that's one of my favorites of your dad's films.
I love that film, and it's always a film sort of lived under the radar, you know? Every time I see it, I think, God, it's just fantastic.
Oxbow Incident gets a lot more attention, I think, just because it's obviously got a message, it's obviously got a statement to make, and I think people think about it a lot. And Yellow Sky, I guess people just perceive it as a Western, but it's just great. It's a terrific cast and the feel of it. And he takes
my father loved that. He loved Yellow Sky. That was one of his favorite pictures.
Yeah. Well, he loved doing the location stuff too, and I mean, he liked getting it gritty, and I think he liked the camaraderie of that, right? It's just like a film. Have you ever seen this one, Beaugest? That you really should sometimes. It's a good one. But he,
what do you mean? I think I know a guy who really likes Beaugest. What is his name? Huh. Frank something.
I've never come across anybody like that. But
I know that's your favorite.
I was just thinking about...
I wish I was on the set of that, but of course...
Oh, boy.
I mean, I was 2 years old. I'm not going to be on the set of that. When they came back to the studio, I think I was on... I think Dad brought whoever was born at that time, which would just be my sister Pat and I. And but I don't have any memory of that at the studio either.
Did your mom ever go to that set down near Yuma?
I don't think she did.
Because they were bringing in wives of other...
Yeah.
You know, it's often... He would always say in interviews, oh, we wouldn't allow a woman on that set. But there were women all over the set all the time.
No, he said there weren't any women allowed on the set. But Brian Dunleavy, he always told that story. He brought the nurse on the set.
But and, I got pictures of Gary Cooper in a group of women. And, you know, there were a bunch. And a lot of guys had their wives flown down. Because there was a flight from Santa Monica Airport to Yuma every day. And so I've looked at all these dispatches, all these teletype things that they would ask for. Your father used a diathermy machine because of his back, I guess. I'm not quite sure what a diathermy machine is. But I think it's like a heating.
Yeah, it's a. I think it's a heating mechanism.
Yeah. And there are several memos about that saying we need this for the diathermy machine, and they would fly it right
for
down.
His arthritis.
Yeah,
and his back, you know, which is broken in two places during the First World War, and you know he had quite a few problems.
Yeah, he was always pretty much in pain for most of his life, wasn't he?
Pretty much.
Yeah, that's.
It never, he never let it get him down. He'd grouse a little bit, but he never felt sorry for himself, or it never was going to stop him from doing what he wanted to do.
Sure. Well, I was thinking of Beaugest and remembering something so weird. I don't know if I've ever asked you about this before, because I got nothing else to say about it, and I'm always curious. There's a teletype message from the studio to the set, and it says, we have tracked down the rumors of the kidnapping plot, and we've assured Mrs. Wellman that everyone is safe. And I've never found...
Oh, I know what that is.
And somebody, another director's children, also, not Woody Van Dyke, but somebody else.
No, what I was going to say is not right. I don't know.
But I've never found anything in the
kidnapping
papers?
Not a kidnapping... On the set,
no.
Or around the
no,
company,
no.
Somebody
apparently threatening you or
oh.
or something, because it says, we have assured Mrs. Wellman that everybody is safe. Like the kids are safe or something like that.
Yeah.
So,
gosh, I don't know.
Yeah. I wish I had remembered to ask Dottie about that one.
Yeah, I see that.
Because I didn't know about it at that time.
You know, Mother, in my writings, I use Mother a lot when, when she was alive, because she had a lot... good memory on things, and it's a big help to things like that.
Yeah,
that you'll never find researching, but somebody,
just strange little stories that that pop up in pieces, and you wonder what was going on here. Something was happening, but and then we find a lot of, as I've researched, and I know as you've researched, you find a lot of things that are. That come out in publicity and are not quite... Like, there's a thing about Gary Cooper trying... Because his daughter is sick, and he's trying to get into Yuma to use the phone because there's a big sandstorm, and the publicity thing says he rode a camel to the highway and then he thumbed his way into Yuma so he could use call about... Yeah. So, just by accident, I found out that what was actually happening... His daughter wasn't sick at all. He was, because a bout of the flu hit the set and hit everybody, and they were all sick. Ray Milland was very sick for like a week, and Gary Cooper was hospitalized, was taken off the set in Buttercup Valley and hospitalized, and that was the truth of the story. But a publicity guy saw that and said, well, we can't have Gary Cooper in the hospital, so let's have him in Yuma worried about his daughter, and that'll...
Oh,
if
boy.
Anybody sees him in Yuma, that'll work. That stuff must have happened all the time.
You know Maria Cooper? Have you met her?
Yeah, yeah.
She's a great gal. And,
she is.
We've been friends ever since they were in the neighborhood.
Yeah, we interviewed her for the Foreign Legion documentary, and she's in a little bit of the doc that I just finished with the Lost Remake of Beaugest.
She's a great gal. I saw her just recently. She was out here last year. February, March, maybe. I forget what month, but she was out here last year and we got together. She showed High Noon up at the Getty, which was fabulous.
Sure.
And so we got to talking again. And I see her once in a while. If I get to New York, I'll look her up.
She's got a great apartment. It's one of those...
Yeah, well...
One of those New York apartments you can only dream about having. So, but I got to hold Gary Cooper's Oscar. That was nice.
Yeah, we had one experience I had with her was a few years ago. My wife and I were in New York staying with a friend of mine, and I called Maria and I said, let's get together. Now, we were there for a wedding, a family wedding, which took place on a Sunday, and we were there on a Saturday, and then Sunday they had a breakfast for the close family of the bride and groom. And then on Monday, I got together with Maria, and we were at the Regency Hotel, and we had tea there. Maria and I and my wife, Flossie. And it started to rain, so we were kind of, you know, we were kind of lamenting about the weather. And I didn't have an umbrella, and they gave me an umbrella, which I still have from the Regency. It says Regency on it. And the next day was 9/11.
Wow. So you were in, you were there?
I told this story in New York this last year. I was there to hosting some of my dad's films. And people said, well, when were the last time you were here? Well, the last time, at that point, the last time I was there was 9/11.
Wow.
So I told the story once or twice, and then I thought, I'm not going to tell this anymore. People didn't like the end of it when I said the next day was 9/11, you know. And I was stuck in New York. We couldn't get out for like five, six more days.
Wow.
It was a horrible experience.
I can't imagine. I know several. I have good friends in New York, of course, and like our mutual friend, John Gallagher. And, yeah, it just sounds surrealistically horrible.
It was horrible, and I started... I only know like two or three people in New York. I don't know many people in New York, but I began to feel like one of them. One of the days that I tried to get, we eventually were staying in the apartment. The bride and groom were on the honeymoon. We were staying in their apartment while they were gone, and it was right in downtown Manhattan. So one night, you know, we tried to get to the airport, and they made us turn around, come back. Couldn't get out, and we went to a little Italian restaurant just down on the corner, and when we came out of the restaurant at maybe 8 o'clock, whatever it was, and there were all these people walking down the street with candles, a candlelight vigil sort of procession, mm-hmm. and we just followed them. We just got in, and they went down a couple blocks, turned right, and they went to this firehouse. And the firemen were just returning from their day in hell. And all these people were crowded around the front of it. And they had all the pictures of the firemen who had perished. And yeah. Their wives and kids were there, and they were crying, and we're crying. And I said, I got to get out of it. I got to get out of here. I can't take this anymore.
Yeah.
It was just, you know.
Yeah. It's one of the worst things that ever happened.
Unthinkable.
Yeah.
Thing, and I wished I'd never been there.
Sure.
I didn't need to be there.
Yeah. I guess not. Yeah, that's something you'll never forget.
Huh? No, so I'll never forget that time with Maria Cooper.
Well, I hope you've had happier memories with Maria Cooper.
Yes,
since
I have.
So. Now, I asked Sissy about this, and she just gave me a look. But I was interested in the fact that all three of your dad's sons appeared in his movies, and none of his daughters ever did. And I asked Sissy, was that just because none of the daughters wanted to be, or just it just didn't happen? And she said, don't ask me.
So, well, first of all, Sissy, for instance, was so young.
Yeah.
She just was so young. As far as the...
And Maggie didn't come along until...
Maggie didn't... You know, Maggie was even younger.
Yeah.
So they were so young. But, I mean, both my brothers were in films before I was with my father a couple of times. They had been in films. I mean, Tim had been in The Happy Years. He was in Island in the Sky. He worked on track. He was the track of the Track of the Cat. Because of his size, he was so small that he would put on these fake, you know, snowshoes and go out and make tracks in the snow.
No, I never knew that.
Yeah. And he was a dog handler on Goodbye, My Lady. And he doubled Brandon DeWilde in Goodbye, My Lady. And let's see. And then my brother Mike, of course, he's the little kid in The High and the Mighty that sleeps through the horrific event.
And he's an Island in the Sky as well.
And he's an Island in the Sky. Both my brothers are Andy Devine's sons in that picture. So they had all worked before I did. And, you know, my father, and I think you've written about it and talked about it, he liked the idea of having family members around and in his films. He liked it. He probably shouldn't have had me in the Lafayette Escadrille. I mean, when you think of me playing him, he's Wild Bill, I'm Mild Bill. And here I am, you know, a freshman at Duke University. I know nothing about acting, absolutely nothing. And to end up in that movie in an important role is pretty kind of crazy.
Well, but it's pretty irresistible too, isn't it? I mean, it's,
well, sure. When he asked me, he says, "You want a test for this movie that I'm doing? It's you're playing me." And I thought, "Oh my God!" You know, because I had never, you know, even though I loved going on his sets and locations and all of that, I never saw a place for myself in the business, and I never really gave it much thought. I always loved movies. And, you know, I was always going to be a baseball player, so I never gave it any thought until this particular episode. So I said, well, what do I do? He says, well, I'm going to give you a scene, and you're going to come out to the studio, and you're going to test. And I thought, okay. So he gave me the scene, didn't give me any instructions or anything. He says, learn these lines. So I learned the lines. And the day came, and I go out there, and the setup was there was one large room with a big conference table at one end. And sitting behind the table is Jack Warner, Steve Trilling, number two guy at Warner mm-hmm. Brothers, head of publicity, head of casting, my father. And the rest of the room is filled with the prospective actors, all sitting in those school chairs, you know. And I thought that was kind of weird to make every, because no, actors don't want to be in with other actors, you know. And then they would call us up and we would do a scene right there live. And for, I think I was called up first, but I, you know, my memory could be not too sharp on that, but I certainly remember doing the scene. And I did the scene with Tab Hunter, who ended up playing the lead in the film. And I think Tab Hunter made me look better because he's the kind of a person when he's nervous, it really shows. And he was very nervous. My nervousness didn't show, but I had volcanic eruptions going on inside me. So I think he made me look better. Mm-hmm. And I knew my lines and I said them. And so my father called me a couple of days later and said, well, Bill, you got the part. Even Jack Warner said, okay. I get the role. And the second day, like the second day on location in Santa Maria, I went to my father and I said, Dad, this is what I want to do. I love this. I said, this is what I want to do. He said, okay. And it was one of the very few times that he ever was against my mother. Because mother wanted me to go, because I didn't go back to Duke my sophomore first semester because I was doing this film. So she wanted me to go back second semester and finish college.
Yeah.
And my father said, you know, no. He says, Bill, he says he can't learn anything about the film industry in college. And in the 50s, you remember, I was in college in 1955, 56. There were no film schools like there are today. You know, there was, you could take theater arts. Some professor would be reading out of some book. So you really couldn't learn anything. And he backed me. And the thing that's really interesting to me, many years later when he was writing his memoirs, he wrote that he was not at all happy that his son became an actor. And at first, when I read that, and I thought, what the heck? But then as I thought about it, I thought, you know, that's really pretty neat. He realized that I really wanted to do this. He didn't try to talk me out of it. He supported my decision.
Yeah.
That's pretty neat, don't you think?
It is. It's pretty neat.
As a father, I know about this stuff. You try to talk to your kids into doing this or that and don't do this, and he never did that.
Yeah. Well, but he was also in a position, I mean, he could have just not hired you too. So
sure.
So he did that, not only that, but for the next film, or Darby's Rangers.
Well, yeah, that was a whole funny period, you know, in the 50s at the studios, at Warner Brothers in particular, because that's where I was. And I did three pictures, one after another. And the first picture, which became known as the Lafayette Escadrille, was held out of release for quite a while, but they wanted me under contract They paid me $400 a week on Lafayette Escadrille. They offered me a term contract at $400 a week, and the actors under contract were getting $250 a week. So I said to my dad, I said, gee, they want to put me under contract. Don't do it. He said, wait till the picture comes out. You'll be able to get much more money. And I said, well, you know, another thing, I don't have an agent. Everyone else has an agent around here. Don't get an agent. Wait till the picture comes out. You'll get any agent you want. So I'm around the studio, and I was working around acting. I was like I was under contract because I went to the talent school. I did all the things that the contract players were doing because I realized that I had so much to learn because I knew absolutely nothing. I mean, nobody ever started in this industry less prepared than me. Even though you say, well, yeah, your father is a director and you've been on all these sets and locations, but that's not the same thing. And my father was not an actor. I knew nothing. And I'm out there and I made nothing but mistakes. Why people hired me, I don't know, for a long time. I didn't learn anything important about acting for about 9 years. And yet I was working all the time. And people were hiring me at Warner Brothers, offering me. I couldn't walk down the studio street without somebody offering me a role. Just because I might be good in this movie when it comes out. It's the weirdest thing that happens in Hollywood.
Sure.
That now they're grinding out the publicity about me in the fan magazines and stuff like that, so people know about me, but they haven't seen my work. They don't know if I'm good or bad or, you know. But they're offering me jobs, and I'm thinking, boy, this is a wonderful business.
So,
I don't know.
Well, first I wanted to ask you about Lafayette Escadrille, because it's such an amazing cast of people. Just as amazing now as it was then, because it's all people who had enormous success. Clint Eastwood, Tom Laughlin. Did you know any of those guys going in, or is that how you met them all?
No, I didn't know any of them. I didn't know anybody. Well, wait a minute. I did know Dennis Devine, Andy Devine's yes. son, because Andy Devine was a good friend of my father's, so our families got together a little bit. So I knew Dennis Devine, and I knew Jody McCrae, Joel McCrae's son, because, again, the McCrae family and the Wellmans were fairly close. So we didn't see a lot of them, but, you know, so I knew them. But to me, that picture tells a whole lot about my father's, let's call it genius. Where he didn't need to look at film on actors and have long auditions and, you know, and here was a film that was, you know, in turmoil in terms of my father wanted James Dean. And when he was killed, then he wanted Paul Newman, who was a new contract player. And he had met with Newman. And actually, the meeting didn't go that well. I remember my father saying, yeah, Newman, this young contract guy, he wanted to tell me how to direct the picture. But I like his attitude. He's right. But Jack Warner told him that he couldn't use Paul Newman because they were putting him under suspension because he was mad at them for the projects they were giving him. Well, if you ever see The Silver Chalice, you'll well, sure. know what Newman was squawking about. Yeah. So, you know, so the casting was, and they actually started to cast people as if Paul Newman was going to do it. And then when at the last, kind of the last minute, Tab Hunter was cast, and remember, Tab Hunter was the golden boy of the 50s. Tab Hunter was the young Tom Cruise of the 50s sure. with a huge fan base, and all his pictures were successful. So when Tab Hunter came into it, then they needed to get some actors who were younger for the teenage audience. That was their thinking. And that's how I came to be, because my father didn't make up the idea of having me in the picture. It was the head of publicity and the head of casting. They came up with this idea to have. So they said to my father, he used to tell this story, they said to my father, well, don't you have a son that's the same age that you were when you were in the war? Yeah, Bill Jr. He says, well, can he act? Well, I don't know. He's going to Duke University, taking business. Well, would you like him to play the role? He says, well, I don't know if he can have. Well, let's bring him out. So, I mean, that's kind of how I got into it. But to go further with that, I was there the day that they, you know, again, this happened to my father many times where the production office would say, you're going to have to delay the picture for this or that reason. And they told him that, you know, until they could, you know, get all the casting set. And my father said, no, not delaying. We're starting on Monday. So he called his assistant director and he said, get a group of actors and bring them over to the parking lot next to my office. And that parking lot, I think, is still there. It's next to Clint Eastwood's Mel Paizo Productions. Sure. And I was walking with my father, and he had a clipboard with the names that the assistant director had given him that he got from casting, and there was a group of maybe 12 or 14 actors there, and my father just walked up and started looking at them and asking questions like, you know, where are you from, what you have for breakfast, you know, all this kind of stuff. And I remember vividly some of the actors are trying to get up in the front line, you know, to get as close to my father as they possibly could. And one actor who's just kind of standing in the back and just sort of embarrassed about the whole thing. And my father said, where are you from? And he says, Universal Pictures. He says, Universal Pictures? He says, yeah, they just dropped my option. He says, you ever played football? Yeah, I've played. Give your name to my secretary. You're playing George Moseley. And the guy writes down Clint Eastwood. And he cast Tom Laughlin, who became Billy Jack, Will Hutchins, who became Sugarfoot, sure. You know. He just could do it by looking at somebody, talking, thinking about whatever, their voice. He always liked voices. And he cast that picture, you know, like that.
Yeah, I never knew that he didn't cast, or he... that it wasn't his idea to cast you, but I've always wondered about the whole Jody McCrae, Dennis Devine, and you.
It all fell into place because of me. They said they were looking for, they thought that might sell tickets. Well, Joel McCrae, his son might sell tickets, but a director's son is not going to sell tickets, really. But anyway, that's how that all came about. And my father was, you know, I think he was, even though he liked the idea of me being in the picture, he probably would have preferred if I was playing just a bit so I could just be around there like his other sons had done.
Sure.
You know? But he accepted it. And when I got the role, I said to him, how do I be an actor? And he says, you don't act. Just be yourself. Well, my first thought was, I want to be better than myself. You know, so he said, learn your lines, don't act, be on time, and no fooling around. That's what he told me. Those were my instructions. I learned my lines, I was on time, and if you see the picture, I'm just myself, I'm just a guy walking around saying his lines. There's no acting going on.
Well, it's a film.
But, you know, let me go one step further. See, there should have been. If I had any kind of preparation, I realized I'm playing Wild Bill Wellman. There should have been a little edge, something else. Because when people used to ask my father, well, how'd you like Bill Jr.'s work in your picture? He says, well, he was fine. It's a nicer version of me. Say, well, it should have been something else.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, it could have been a real hellraiser like he was.
Well, a little more.
Yeah.
But I, what the hell did I know? Nothing.
You know, that picture often gets kind of downgraded, but I've always liked it. And even, you know, I'm not convinced that if I saw it with its original ending and everything, that I would like it more. I think the happy ending doesn't quite come out of nowhere. It works in its own way, and I think it would be so depressing the other way that it originally ended with both main characters.
Well,
dying,
of course, you know, they shot it. It was made the way my father had wanted it to be made, with the tragic ending, And with, you know, what the studio took out of it was they took flying and they took relationships of the guys out of it to focus more attention on the love story with Tab Hunter and Achika Shiro. And they were going to call it With You in My Arms and things like that. And with a happy ending so his teenage fans wouldn't be upset. But if you think of that picture, let's say with Paul Newman, you know, much less James Dean.
Sure.
And the story, the way it was written, it would have worked. It would have been, I think, an artistic gem. But, you know, it wasn't to be, and it so upset my father that he quit the business.
I have heard rumors that there is a work print of the original film around.
Well, I can give you rumors, too, because I heard rumors, and I had somebody at Warner Brothers, George...
Feldenstein?
Yeah. He said he thought there was, and then he came back and said, no, unfortunately, it's not.
Mm.
But they found a print back in Kansas City. I guess they have a big storage.
Yeah.
And they thought they had it, but... I love those rumors, and I used to. There was quite a long time where I was calling people, and when I would work at Warner's, I would go over there to editorial and post-production, anything around there, and see if I could get somebody to start looking into. But you see, Jack Warner, as I'm sure you know, he had his standard thing was, if he changed the movie, he wanted to make sure everything that was taken out of it was gone.
Yeah.
He didn't want anything
That's
showing
really a
up.
Shame. The other one of your dad's films that is even worse is Across the Wide Missouri,
because
that was just gutted.
Yeah.
And what's there is so terrific, and it really makes me sad to think of what it should be.
Well, you know, James Whitmore had a very important role in the original, the whole beginning of the picture.
Yeah, he's barely there.
You know, of course, when I talked to him about it, he's not happy with that either. But, of course, that was one of the start of the downfall with my father and Dory Sherry at MGM, because they just, you know, wrecked that picture to the point where even they couldn't understand it. They had to hire Howard Keel, uncredited, to narrate the whole picture.
Yeah.
It was so screwed up.
Well, that seemed to be what Dory Sherry did. He did it again with Red Badge of Courage, the John Huston picture, which is around the same time, and just completely chopped it up and then put in a narration to try to make some sense of it.
And you know, the funny thing is, it was Dory Sherry's project when he went across the wide, when he gave it to my father. My father didn't want to do it. He didn't want to make another picture. He'd made three pictures in a row, and he wanted to take some time off. So Dory Sherry said, well, yeah, but this is a different Western. I mean, you like it, and I'll get Clark Gable. And, of course, my father said, now, wait a minute. You know, Clark Gable and I are not on speaking terms after Call of the Wild. I mean, I've seen him a few times, but we're not, you know, I don't think he'll work with me. So Sherry took care of that, and he got back to my father. He said, no, Gable said he'd love to work with you. And my father read the script, I guess, and liked it. So, I mean, all he did, he took that script and he shot that movie, and then Dory Sherry didn't like it. And now he starts messing around. My father's off doing Westward the Women, I think, at the time. So by the time he saw what they did to it, he was really ticked.
Such a shame. Now, as you said, your family was on that location the whole time.
Every one of us were there.
And, Were you actually watching the production, or were you just treating it like a family holiday? And
I watched the shots. See, I love that.
Yeah,
I like to stay near the director. You know, I would stay near my father, not too close, but I wanted to see what he was doing, and I would go off and look at things, and of course on that particular picture. My father made sure that every set was built on a body of water, a lake, a river, stream, something. And he told the production manager before the picture started to hire a crew that liked to fish, because he says, I wrap at 5 o'clock every day and we're going to fish. So, and I fished. I fished with Clark Gable. You know, he told me one day, he says, hey, Bill, I've got a place. There's a little lake. We have to walk a little bit over the hill down the other side. But I think there's a lot of trout in there. You want to go down there? I said, sure. I went down there and chatting with him all the way, and he was a great guy. He had no attitude. You know, he was just a guy you could sit down and have a drink with, chat yeah. with. He was fabulous.
Yeah, someday we'll see that picture in its entirety, maybe. Maybe it'll show up somewhere.
Really? You think the...
Eh, I keep hoping for these things. I keep hoping for the uncut Beaujesse, too, but, you know.
Well, I keep hoping for Legion of the Condemned, if you want to know something I'm hoping for.
Oh, boy, you and me both.
Boy, I'd like to see that.
Yeah, I think of the Lost Ones, that's probably the number one... thing, you know?
It's a sad thing when I read through your book of lost films, mm-hmm. you know, I hate that films are lost, you know, and you
so
start reading about it and you go, oh my God, but now they keep turning up though.
Yeah.
So you never know.
It's amazing, you know, that, that cache of films they found in New Zealand 2 years ago, and I think it was 2010, it's like 100 features that... were not known to exist anywhere else in there, or not all features, some shorts, but miracles still happen, so we keep our fingers crossed.
Yeah.
So, what about Darby's Rangers? Now that shot after Lafayette Escadrille, but was actually released before Lafayette Escadrille. Where did you... That was all on the soundstage, right?
Well, that was... in order to do... Lafayette Escadrille was originally called C'est la Guerre. That was my father's title. And he had been trying to make that picture for years and years and years. No one would... You know, Daryl Zanuck turned him down. David O. Selznick turned him down. Dory Sherry turned him down. You know, he finally got it done, got the contract at Warner's because of The High and the Mighty, really. Because Jack Warner was releasing all of the John Wayne films, and The High and the Mighty was so successful
yeah.
that Warner wanted my father at the studio again. So, and but still, he said, in order for you to be able to make this C'est la Guerre movie, you've got to do it on a lower budget, and you've got to do one picture for me, sight unseen. Whatever script I give you, you've got to make it. Without changing it, and also I'll hire the one main lead, and you'll take care of all the rest of the roles. So my father contractually was stuck with that. So even when the Lafayette Escadrille was finished shooting, of course it was still called C'est la Guerre probably at that time. He started on Darby's Rangers, and again this is another wonderful story about my father's casting. Jack Warner, my father read the script and he thought it was an okay war film. He didn't think there was anything special about it. I mean, my God, he had done G.I. Joe and Battleground, sure. Talk about special war films. And this was just a, you know, kind of a mediocre story to him. And during the shooting of it, of course, he was always trying to interject something into the story, some humor, something else. He was always working that way. But anyway, Jack Warner was dealing with Charlton Heston and Burt Lancaster, one of the two of them, and he settled on Heston, and evidently Heston had said yes, he would do it. And then as it got closer to production time, he wanted more money, he wanted a piece of the picture, and the whole thing fell apart. So, again, the word came to my father he was going to have to delay the start of the picture. Now, my father had cast the rest of the picture and also had hired a drill instructor from Fort Benning, Georgia, to give the actors 2 weeks of basic training, which he had done on G.I. Joe and Battleground. You know, that's something that he liked to do.
Sure.
And we're out in the back lot of Warner Brothers going through basic training, and I later went into the service and had basic training, and it was just as difficult on the back lot of Warner Brothers. Wow. With this drill instructor from Fort Benning, Georgia. And we're all out there, Jim Garner and Stuart Whitman and other, you know, a whole bunch of us. And we'd been out there for 2 weeks, and my father said to Jack Warner, I'm not waiting. And he sent the assistant director out to the back lot. He drove up in a limousine. I'll never forget this. Got out of the limousine. Said to the drill instructor, "Form your troops." And he called for us to fall in. And we're all lined up, looking at the assistant director, George Vieira. And we're standing like soldiers. We're beginning to think we're soldiers. And that was the whole idea in my father's mind. We're not actors anymore. We're soldiers. So the Vieira says, "There's been a problem with the casting. So everybody move up one part." I'll never forget that line. And we're standing there, and I happen to have Jim Garner on my left and Stuart Whitman on my right. And Jim Garner says, "Well, if I move up one part, then I'm the lead." And Vieira says, "That's right. Get in the car. Wellman wants to see you." Whitman says, "Do I take his role?" "Yeah, you move up." I said, "Do I take another role?" He says, "No, you're still Eli Clatworthy," character that I was playing. So, I mean, people moved up one part.
Wow.
Can you imagine that? And Jim Garner became the lead, and then he did, was Maverick, and, you know.
Yeah, stardom.
So.
I wanted to ask you about one other big director you worked with, John Ford. I tend to end up talking on this podcast about Ford quite a bit for some reason, and I think because I find him so interesting, and he's the one of those guys who seemed to have just been such an awful man in many ways, and yet makes these beautiful movies. What was your experience? You were on Horse Soldiers, and you were in, were you in his segment of How the West Was Won?
Yes.
So he was directing you
there? I was in his stock company for three pictures in a row. And here's what happened.
What's the other one?
Sergeant Rutledge.
Oh, okay.
My agent calls me. I'd never met John Ford. I mean, I knew my father knew him, but I never met him. And my agent calls me and says, "Bill, you got an audition over at Columbia to see John Ford." I said, "What? John Ford?" I just started to work in Westerns at this time. My first Western job was in Have Gun, Will Travel in 1958. And this was soon after I'd done the one Western job. So anyway, I go over there and I'm thinking, "Oh my God, John Ford." And I called my agent. I said, "Do you have a scene or something for me to read?" And he said, "No, they didn't have anything for me." I said, "Well, they'll probably give me a scene when I get over there." So I go over there and I walk up to the receptionist and I, you know, sign in. I said, "Have you got a scene here for me?" "No, we don't have anything." I thought, well, I guess maybe he's going to give me something when I get in the office and maybe I'll do a cold reading or something. I don't know. So I sit there and my turn comes and I walk into this room. And in the room is, you know, a regular office. There's a desk. John Ford is sitting on one side of the desk, and he's got the chair on the other side up real close. So when I sit, my knees are touching his desk. I'm as close to him as you and I are.
Mm-hmm.
That's exactly right. Standing over in the corner is John Lee Mahon, the writer. There's nobody else in the room. So when I walk in, Mahon says, "Hey, Bill, how are you?" I sit down. Ford hasn't said anything yet. I sit down, and I'm looking at him. He's got a patch over one eye, you know, and he's just staring at me with this one beady eye. And I'm feeling really, you know, like my skin is starting to crawl a little bit, and I'm waiting for him to say something, and he finally says, "Do you like horses?" I said, "Yeah, sure. I like horses." "How much do you like horses?" I said, "Well, you know, we always had two horses on our property. My father always had horses, and, you know, we all rode, and, you know, I like horses." He says, "So you do like horses?" Yeah, I do. "All right, you can leave." So I left, and I thought, what the hell? I called my agent. I said, "That was the worst audition I've ever had. You know, he just wanted to know if I liked horses, and God, that's, I don't know what was going on." A few days later, he calls me up. He says, "Bill, You're on the horse soldiers. You got an 8-week guarantee. You're going to Louisiana. You're a bugler. I thought, what the heck? I couldn't figure this out. I'm all excited. I go down there. You know, I go to Western Costume. I get my bugler's outfit here in Los Angeles, and I go to Louisiana. And the first day, they take all of us in a bus, in a giant bus, a couple of buses, out to this beautiful location, the river, and this beautiful out in Louisiana. And we get out of the bus, and there's all the stunt riders, you know, and actors and everything. And here comes John Ford walking up, and I'm thinking, well, I guess we're going to get a, you know, welcome to the company speech here. And he walks up and he looks and he says, listen here, there's no actors in this film, you're all writers. And he turned and walked away. That's how we got started. Now, being that I always like to be around the director, if I'm not, you know, in the scene or something, I always like to watch what was going on. And a little later that day, John Ford is sitting in a director's chair looking out at this river, this scene, and they're setting up the lights and they're setting up this shot. And I'm standing, you know, I don't know, maybe 15, 20 yards behind him. And I'm just so happy in my bugler's outfit, you know, and I'm just whistling. And all of a sudden, everyone stops work. And Ford turns around, looks at me, and I'm and then I stop whistling, and then he turns back and everyone goes back to work. And I thought, what? And I walked over to the script supervisor. I said, what was that? He says, don't ever whistle around the old man, and don't laugh, don't tell any jokes or anything unless he starts. So I walked back and I thought, okay, I don't know the rules of the game here. You know, I'm not staying anywhere near him because I want to last for 8 weeks on this picture. And I tried to stay clear of him, and he would pick somebody, Wayne, almost every day, Wayne, berating him. It was awful to watch. He was cruel to people, nasty to people. Then he would bring out, you know, Dan Borzaghi, who would play the
accordion.
The accordion, and they'd sing "Bringing in the Sheaves," and you know, and they'd have tea every day at 4 o'clock. And but boy, I tried to stay clear of him. One day, I was invited to have tea. Now that was a special privilege because there was only at the table there would be maybe 6 or 7 people, and they were, you know, John Wayne and William Holden and Althea Gibson and Constance Towers and, you know, a few people, or, you know. And believe me, I only spoke when I was spoken to because I didn't know, you know, the scenes that I did when he called me Young Young. That was my name. He'd say to the assistant writer, get Young Young over here. So I'd come running up, you know, and he'd give me some direction on something, you know, with a handkerchief hanging out of his mouth, and you couldn't understand it. But I realized years later that's, if you look at the so-called juveniles in his picture, they're all nervous because they don't know what the hell they're doing.
Sure.
He wants them that way. And I was that way, you know, all the way through it. One time, we're in a long line, the troopers, you know, with our horses, and we're standing with we got the reins, and we're standing right by our horses in a long line, ready to mount and to go into this scene. And I'm maybe 15 people back at this time. And we always wondered if he could see it all. Because with this patch, and if he was looking at script pages, he would bring it up like this, and he would flip the patch up, and he would look like this. And you just wondered, what the hell does this guy really see at any distance? Mm-hmm. Well, all of a sudden, I'm just standing there holding the reins to my horse, and he comes running up to me. I mean, at first I don't know he's coming to me, but he comes right up to me, and he grabs my hat and drops it on the ground and stomps on it, and he puts it back on my head all dirty and all like this, and he says, stop shaving, and he walked away. See, I look too neat. He saw, you know, he can see, you know, as much as he wants, but I tell you, I got, on the whole picture, I got 2 compliments. The first one was, after 8 weeks filming in Louisiana, we came back to the studio for like a week, week and a half or something, and just did some pickup shots. And he kept me on when he did that, and he had a scene, one of those things where he says, "Get young, young." And I came over, he says, "Get on that horse, and when I say action, you come riding in, and you dive under the cannon, and you say to the lieutenant, 'Are you all right? Are you all right, sir?' And when he says, 'Okay,' you get out and you get on there, and you ride off fast you can." So I kind of caught it. So I came riding in, I dismounted, I did the thing, I got on the horse, went up, and as I was, and he said, "Cut!" And he says, "Good job, young, young!" And that was the first compliment I got. The second compliment was, I was invited on the next picture.
Yeah. That's the biggest compliment of all, isn't it?
But it was something. He, I never understood him. Now, I don't know, maybe you've talked to some people when he was younger. Was he this nasty? Because now, this is the end of his career, so.
He seems to have always been like that. And it's amazing to me, because you look at his films, and often they're just so beautiful and emotional, and
yeah,
and it just seems to be made by a poet and with a beautiful heart, and then you just hear nothing but horrible stories about how he behaved, especially with actors. Like you said, there's a story on every film about who mm-hmm. he would choose to just bully, and
yeah,
you know, he broke one of Dobie Carey's ribs one time, just jumped on him.
As an actor, you know, a working actor trying to make a living, when someone calls you and you get 10 weeks on a picture, you know, it was important, you know.
Well, what about How the West Was Won? You're only in a single shot, as I recall, right? I mean, you're one of the doctor's assistants when the very poorly chosen double for James Stewart as his corpse is brought in. As a matter of fact, I probably saw that film 10 times before I ever noticed you were there, because the screen is so big, you tend to look at specific places in it, you know. And one time I went to see it at the Cinerama Dome, and I said, "I'm just going to spend this entire screening looking away from the action. Like, if Debbie Reynolds is kissing somebody over here, I'm going to look over there." Mm-hmm. And I'm just going to see what else is going on, because it's so
there. Geez. There I was over there.
Yeah. And there you are. Yes. Because when they bring in the body and they flop him down on the table and they say, you know, "This is Linus Rawlings." And so you're always looking there. Mm-hmm. And then, but you're up here. So.
Well, you know, you never got a script.
Yeah.
You never knew what you were going to do. You're on board. You're there to do whatever, you know, whatever comes up. And mostly I'm just writing and doing all the writing scenes. And then, you know, every once in a while he'll throw you in there to do something, like that scene you're talking about. Comes out of the blue.
Yeah.
That's just the way it was. But that, you know, again,
that was an interior scene, wasn't it? Mm-hmm. And so, did they shoot it here?
Yeah,
or was it on the location?
You no, were in Hollywood. It was, everything I did in How the West Was Won was shot on the back lot there of what was it, MGM Pathé? You know,
yeah.
Back there they had that town, you know, that kind of westernish town that's in the picture where the train comes in. I haven't seen the picture for a long time, so I'm a little.
The last part has a
typical
Western town sort of.
Yeah, yeah. And that's, and the interiors were there at the studio, and you know.
So do you have any memory of Ford doing that? I mean, he didn't seem to have had much interest in that segment. judging, it's kind of the one segment of the film that it's all interiors, mm-hmm. even the Battle of Shiloh, which is an exterior scene, but it's clearly on a soundstage.
Yeah.
And it's the one segment of that film that doesn't look right. And everything else is so spectacular.
Now, I don't have a lot of memories of that. Again, you know, I was on it for quite a few weeks.
Yeah.
Happy for the work. But on the Ford thing, you know, when I finished, after How the West was won, I think he only made one picture, Cheyenne Autumn. I guess he figured I didn't look like an Indian.
And Seven Women, but that was...
Seven Women,
okay. But you're not a woman, so no. There you go.
And that was the end of his career. But I saw him once after that, and I went with my father to the Directors Guild for some... There was some gathering that my father went to, and I can't remember what the gathering was. I think I can look it up. I'll be able to find it back in my in stuff that I've got in storage. Anyway, I go there with my father, and there's John Ford. And my father walks up to him. Hey, Jack, how you doing? You know, hi, Bill, you know. And my father says, well, you know my son, Bill. Well, of course he knows me, but... And he goes, yeah, you know. Now, oh, let me back up a little bit. After the John Ford films, I started doing a lot of Westerns on television. I did 16 episodes of television Westerns. And every time I did one that I thought was pretty good, I would write John Ford. I knew where he lived, so I had his address. I'd write him a letter. I'd send him a Western shot of myself or something. Or I'd send him a mailer saying, I'm on tonight at 8 o'clock, Gunsmoke, you know, this sort of thing. I never got an answer, but I thought he might still make films and he might make Westerns, and you know. So I'm at the Directors Guild now with my father, and my father is chatting with him, and the two of them start to move forward, and I'm behind them, and Ford turns back, you know, and he says to me, stop writing me. And then he turned and walked away. But you know, I still am so appreciative that I worked for John in John Ford's couple of his films. Yeah. I mean, to me, I love that stuff.
Well, he's one of the greatest directors who ever lived. I mean, there's no
doubt
about
anyone. I mean, I worked with Tay Garnett. I worked with Louis Milestone. There were quite a few of those guys that I fortunately was able to work with. I love that.
Yeah. Well, Garnett was also... He's one of those directors that people have not quite caught up with yet, because you don't hear a lot of people talking about him, and yet he's terrific.
Yeah.
Really great stuff. And I've got a list of kind of forgotten directors and that people just don't talk about, but who did, like George Marshall.
Well, I saw you. Like, yeah, I worked for George Marshall, too.
Yeah.
I know you did a book on Henry King.
Yeah.
See, now there's a guy who no one talks about either who's done a lot of great work.
Oh, sure. Oh, I love Henry
Tay Garnett. You know, I wish I had that film. I did a pilot for CBS in 1960 or 61 called Warbirds. And it was about First World War pilots. And CBS had made this pilot the year before, and it didn't sell, but they still liked it, so they wanted it recast and do it again, and Tay Garnett was the director, and they hired Wade Preston, who was a cowboy star, mm-hmm. Colt 45, or I think was the name of the series that he did, and I was one of the regulars as one of the pilots, and Frank Tallman did the air aviation mm-hmm. stuff, and it was kind of neat because like in Casablanca, Ricks. See what happened when we weren't on a mission. We went to Paris and we went to Hoagie's, Hoagie Carmichael. Wow. It wasn't Ricks, but it was just like it. He was in there tinkling the piano, and it looked like Ricks in Casablanca. And our commandant was Basil Rathbone.
Wow.
And I thought, and that was great.
I love to see this.
He was great. I love talking to him. He was great. But they were so cheap that you got the feeling that, you know, we'd be there and Basil Rathbone would be giving us our orders for this mission. And we'd walk out the door to get to a planes, and you'd see the plane warming up, and then we would come back in. Boy, that was a tough mission. That was, you know. I mean, they wouldn't shoot any.
Yeah.
And Tallman said, look, let me shoot some aerial stuff, some combat stuff. I won't charge you anything for it. Just put it there to show what can be done. See, and they wouldn't do it. Well, it didn't sell. But Hoagie Carmichael, when he was alive, he was trying to find this film. But in those days, you know, it was an hour pilot. In those days, today they would it would be on as like a feature or something.
Sure.
But in those days, they threw it away. They made all these pilots, and if they didn't sell, they threw them away. So nobody can find us. But wow. I would love to have that. And the stuff with Hoagy Carmichael in the bar is fantastic stuff.
We're going to get our friend John Gallagher on this because he's, you know, he's been trying to write a book on Tay Garnett for years. I bet he knows where this thing is.
Ooh. Boy,
I'd love to
I've tried different ways to find it, but no one can find it.
We'll put out the feelers. You know. Who knows what will happen.
So now,
We're getting kind of long.
No, but Tay Garnett was a wonderful guy, incidentally. Oh. We're talking about John Ford. Tay Garnett was, you know, was a gentleman and treated people well. He was wonderful.
Yeah, I think there were directors who knew how to be human beings and still get good work out of people. There's a lot that I've studied who were the other way, but anyway. I'll ask you two things before we finish up. One, I'm guessing that you're probably as well known for your Star Trek connection as anything these days, right? I mean, that's probably a big...
Yeah.
You do a lot of those conventions and everything, right?
I started doing them in 2003, and I've done a lot of them. I just did one over at the Burbank Marriott there by the Bob Hope Airport. And I did a segment of Deep Space Nine back in 1997, and I played a Bajoran. And they're the militaristic people. And it was a good role. And somebody, a promoter came to me and said, you know, you should do these Star Trek. And I said, hey, I did one episode of Deep Space Nine. I don't really have a connection with that. He said, no, you got to do it. You know, they'll know it. And, you know, you'll sign a lot of photographs. And, you know, and I thought, oh, well, they, you know. So I tried it. I went to one. And, oh, my God, the fans just came out of nowhere. They knew the show. I didn't even have pictures from it. I had to go get video grabs, and you had to go to Paramount to get them, and they have to be licensed, you know. And I got these video grabs from scenes that I did. And when I looked at the photographs, they were not really clear because they're coming off of a television show. And I thought, nobody's going to want this. Well, they love that. They love it even more because it's not a photographer didn't take me aside and say, okay, now smile and take the... It was right from the scene. And they know. And people would come up, when I do these shows, they come up to me and they know the dialogue. Now, the show was shot in November of 1997. I don't remember. The first time somebody came up to me, I was absolutely shocked. I couldn't have, if you'd have pointed a gun at me, I couldn't tell you one word that I said then. They knew all the dialogue, the name, the segment of the show. One woman came up to me, Favor the Bold is my favorite episode on Deep Space Nine. I love it so much that I just got a new dog and I call him Favor, from Favor the Bold. I mean, these stories I get all the time.
Wow.
And I have sold 100 pictures from that. But now I did a starring role in a Star Trek film called Deep Space, called Of Gods and Men, Star Trek of Gods and Men, which plays on the internet. And now I'm playing Charlie X, who's a very well-known character from the original series. So now I've got that to boot. So it's a real kick. It's a whole other world out there.
Sure.
When you do those conventions and those people, and there are thousands of them. I mean, the Vegas show will have 25,000 people there in a long weekend.
Wow.
25,000 people. And some of those people save money all year long and get in their car and they drive across country to that convention. There are hundreds of other ones that travel the circuit. I see the same people that I saw in 2003 when I did my first one.
Mm.
And they know everything. They know all the shows, all those Star Trek shows.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
Well, it just goes to show you, you never know what's going to make your cultural impact, do you? That's
Oh, of course, with me, because my, you know, my work is, I've done so many different kinds of things,
sure.
And I have pictures from all this stuff, so it's always a kick to me what people, what surprises me the most is there's nothing that I've done that somebody doesn't know about.
Yeah.
You know, and I've done some bad films that, you know, no one, that I tried to hide for a long time, but now they say these are cult classics.
Sure. Macumba Love.
You know.
It's one of the greats.
Well, unfortunately, there's a Macumba Love Society.
Wow.
They contact me.
I'm not surprised.
Now that's, but you see, that film to me is the worst movie ever made that made money, and it made a lot of money. It caused such a turmoil and litigation and everything else that it just sort of disappeared. You can only find pirated versions of it, and it looks awful. But there's a guy named, you probably know him, Kit Carson. Do you know him? He's a guy who buys these sort of films that are, you know, unusual films, exploitation films, crazy films, bad films, and he kind of resurrects them, you know. He restores them a little bit if he can find anybody who's in them to do some commentary. So June Wilkinson, who plays my wife, and I, we did commentary for this. But he couldn't get, there's one living producer, for whatever reason, he won't give up any rights to it.
Wow.
And yet he won't do anything with it. So that's strange, because people know that film.
Yeah, that's Shades of Lester Cowan.
And that's something you can't even get, that film.
Yeah.
You know, where some of the other ones you can get, and by God, you know, I wish, you know, but anyway.
Well, before we end up, I want to ask you a little bit about the documentary, because I don't think we've ever talked about.
Oh, I need to tell you about that.
The documentary itself, yeah. Wild Bill Hollywood Maverick, which you executive produced and which I was on the peripheral sidelines throughout. But tell me about how that came to you to do that and how it came to be.
Well, first of all, we're coming out on DVD. We just signed a deal with Kino Lorber, so we'll be coming out in DVD, Frank. So
good,
happy to tell you that.
I'll get one.
That's a project that, you know, I've had this passion to try to shine a light on my father's career since really back in the early 1960s. But to shorten the story, that was a project that I started, you know, 25 years before I finally got it made. And I had made, you know, proposals to, you know, cable companies, and, you know, I was always trying to push for that. I had written a script for it. I even talked to John Wayne one time. That's how far back it goes, when he was still alive. And he said he would do a guest appearance in it. And but I never could get any interest in it. And then one of my daughters knew Todd Robinson, a documentarian. And Todd Robinson had said to my daughter, you know, somebody should do a documentary on your grandfather. And she said, well, my dad's been working on it. So we got together, and I went through I talked to him, and I liked him. And I liked where he was coming from. I liked his ideas on it, because they were my ideas. He didn't see that this should be done any differently than I did, and so forth. But I made a partnership with him because I thought he could put this together. He said, oh, I can put this together. He had just won an Emmy for a documentary on Billy the Kid.
Mm-hmm.
So turns out he couldn't get it done either. He got rejected by the cable companies. And then he brought in another young producer, Ken Carlson, who was producing, one of the producers of America's Most Wanted. And the three of us sat down and we decided, look, if we'll put our own, the thing is, we're losing people that were important to my father's life. See, you know, we had lost Barbara Stanwyck, and Ginger Rogers was in a wheelchair, and, you know, and that was the thing that was most important. The rest of it could be done at any time, but we needed to get these people, because my whole idea was that the only people that we would interview would be people who had worked for my father. That was the original idea. So the three of us put our money together, and started shooting the interviews, which took some 8 months, I think, as I remember. Of course, you know, I said right off the bat, we're going to have Frank Thompson and John Gallagher to be our historians. That's a given. And so we started shooting these interviews, and lo and behold, we ran out of money, and I sold it to Turner Entertainment off of a rough cut. Plus, I had been promoting it through one person that I knew in Turner Entertainment, and I sold it off the rough cut to TNT, to Turner, and that paid for our... I mean, you're not supposed to make money on documentaries, but we paid all our bills and had a profit. We nice. Were into profit, and we go on the air back in, what was it, 1996?
Yeah.
So anyway, that's how it happened. It was a very, very difficult project for me to work on because I was so afraid that somehow this... Now I had two partners, and I'd been in three people partnerships before, and they had never turned out well. It always ends up two against one somewhere along the line, and I was desperately concerned. But I was fortunate that my partners were terrific, and we never had that problem. What problems we had were so minor. The thing is, we got the show. I got the show I wanted, so I was happy. I had to give a little on screen credits simply because when we made our world premiere at the London Film Festival in London in 1990, in November or December of 1995, they had, you know, critics and, you know, reviewers from all over the world. And one after another, they gave me all the credit. Bill Jr.'s ode to his father. William Wellman Jr.'s... They yeah. never talked... They didn't even mention Ken, who was the producer. Didn't even mention his name. And Todd was just sort of also ran. And so, you know, they said to me, you know, Bill, this is the way it's going to be, and we're not going to get any credit for the work that we did. Everyone thinks of them as, you know, they're my hired guns. So we changed the credits, and I didn't care. In fact, I was trying to move. I was originally going to narrate the whole thing. But I knew that wouldn't work because these people, when I got together 28 people who were interviewees, shall we say, and except for two or three, these were all people that I got that were, you know, major stars and people that I knew. And if I'm looking at them, you know, asking them questions, if I'm narrating the whole thing, it's not going to be the kind of a show I want. First of all, they're not going to talk to me. So I said to Todd, I said, look, you we'll work out the questions, but you ask them. And I would get out of the way. I don't want to be in their sight line. I don't want them to see me. So that they'll answer honestly to you, you know. So it really, you know, it worked out very well. I was just so happy about the film that I got, you know. And Todd was just fabulous. And once we finished the interviews and we got into post-production and when the editing started, I couldn't even go down there. I would go down once a week to see what he was doing, but I was like played out. I'd been so, I mean, after 25 years, I mean, I just was so, I was beat up. I felt beat up.
Yeah.
And yet, to interview these people, and all the interviews went great. You were there. I mean, there was no problem, but I was just always worried that I was going to have this problem somewhere in editing. It was going to change. It was, you know, I did everything I could. For instance, since I got all the film clips, I got every one of them.
Sure.
I only got the clips from the pictures that I wanted in the show. I only got the people that were interviewed because the deal was everyone who was interviewed was going to be in the show. So in a sense, I'm writing because I wanted to make sure this turned out the way I wanted it.
Sure.
And then Todd, the choices that he made were wonderful. And it just, I think it's just, I'm so happy to have that film. That's the happiest thing that I have in my career, shall we say, that I have that film. I'm just so pleased with it. And you did a great job. You know, I couldn't.
Thank you.
I could not do that film without. I told Todd, you know, I said, well, Frank's going to be the historian. He said, well, I don't know him. I said, don't you worry about it. He's the historian. He says, well, can I meet him? I said, of course you can meet him. But he's done so much work on my father for so many years. I mean, he's got to be here, you know.
Yeah, it was a pleasure.
So
the only thing I argued with Todd about on the first day I met him, and I never changed my mind, and he never changed his, was he told me in that first meeting that he didn't want any interview footage of your father in the film. And I said, I think that's a big mistake.
Well, that's my fault, though.
Yeah, I think it's
because... Yeah, see, I said, well, go ahead and finish.
Yeah, well, because, you know, I was interested in your dad's films, especially Beaujesse. That was the big deal for me when I was a kid. And so I sought out some more of his films as I grew up. But I didn't really seriously start thinking about him until Richard Schickel's Men Who Made the Movies came on. And watching him on screen and hearing him tell these stories and all that, I said, man, this is an interesting guy. And also a fascinating, compelling person. And so that's what I said to Todd. I said, come on, this is a guy.
Right or wrong, we made the decision. See, I didn't want, first of all, let me go back. The interview footage that has been done of my father, I don't like anywhere near as much as I like interviews that he had when there was no camera rolling. He had a way of, sometimes he even started sounding English and theatrical, and that's not quite the way he is. The way you see in Richard Schickel's show, which I love his show, is not quite the way he really is. And that bothered me a little bit. Also, I wanted to have this to be about the people who knew him, who worked with him, you know, not about him talking about his work. And Todd agreed with me on it, and that's why we didn't go that direction. Another thing that was very strong with me was when I saw the George Stevens documentary, A Filmmaker's Journey, sure. I think it's called, which won an Oscar, for God's sakes. I saw that and I said, this is exactly what I don't want to do with my documentary, because George Stevens Jr. is all over the piece.
Sure.
And
yeah, it's as much about
when you finish seeing it, you know everything about George Stevens, the filmmaker, but nothing about George Stevens, the man.
Yeah.
And I want to have this so we know about the man. We want, through the eyes of people who knew him best and worked with him. And that was my whole thought on that.
Yeah.
I've never had a second thought that we should have, because I had footage of my father that I could have used.
Yeah.
I love that in the collection, Warner Brothers collection, Forbidden Hollywood 3, where on one disc is our documentary and Schickel's.
Yes.
I love that because you get to our documentary, you get to see what other people thought about my father, and then you get on George, on the other one, you get to see my father talking about, so you get it both ways.
Yeah. No, that's great.
Right or wrong, that was, you know, I always felt that from the very beginning, and it's personal because I don't like my father on screen as anywhere near as much. It's not that I don't like him, but I don't like him as well as the way he is without a camera.
I think he just leaps off the screen. I think he's just
It's just a little. There's a little something that's strictly something I would see, and maybe
absolutely
nobody else.
I understand that. No. So I forgive you. It's a great film, and it's you know, that was the one quibble I always had with it. But
well, we made a few mistakes, really, Frank. We said
a few.
We said with Buddy Rogers' Pick Fair. My father did not land on Pick Fair because there was not Pick Fair for another year, year and a half. But I've researched this pretty thoroughly. And there, first of all, and I'm sure you know this, there were a lot of polo fields in the area, Beverly Hills, you know, all around. And it was another polo field, and it was something that Hollywood did for parties. They had polo games, and they would have parties on the polo field, and it was something. So when my father said he landed on the polo field, I don't know that he ever said Pick Fair. I think we came up with that, and it's wrong.
Yeah.
But I didn't know it at the time. I'd like to strike that out because I don't like to make those mistakes. So there's a couple of other mistakes in there, too. Yeah. I forget now. But
there are a lot of things. You know, when I look at my book, which, God help me, is 30 years old now, there are a lot of things that I would not have considered mistakes then, but now I know things I didn't know then because it's 30 years later. I've been researching this stuff all this time.
God, Frank,
think of,
I'm his son. I was his companion, particularly in the last, you know, 5, 6, 7, 8 years. I've done so much research on him. I produced the only retrospective of his work that he ever had during his lifetime in the United States. I did this documentary. I've written a book. I'm still coming up with stuff. My father's life is so unbelievable, isn't it? There's no end. If you want to take a point of view or something and work another way, you'll find something. There's no end to it. So I've given up the fact that I know it all because I'll never know it all.
You know, John Gallagher and I have been working on this book, and over the past 6, 8 months, I bet we've added 60 pages of stuff that we didn't know before that. And we were ready to finish it before that. And we just found...
You'll never finish it. You'll never have all the information. You got to realize that.
So,
and I've given... I've settled with myself on that.
Well, sure.
There's no way I can know it all.
No. But we keep trying.
So, that's right.
Now, speaking of which, what's the progress on your book?
Is it ready to go? I'm waiting for my publishing date.
Great. And what's the publisher? Can you say?
Random House.
Wow. That's a real publisher.
I had to write a book. First of all, they rejected me like every other publisher did on a full biography of my father's life. They all rejected me. Then I got the deal with a smaller publisher on a portion of his life, you know, The Man and His Wings, my book about my father and his life up to and including the making of Wings. And when that book came out, I got a call from Random House saying, you know, congratulations on your book. Now would you write a complete biography, birth to death, on your father?
Wow.
So I had to write one. Now, no one ever said, well, we don't know if you can write a book. See, they never said that to me. They always said things like, well, you know, your father's so much a filmmaker of yesterday that we think it would take too much time and energy to try to remind people who he was. And, I've got letters from big publishers saying those kinds of things.
Sure.
So anyway.
That's why you always get turned down. They don't think that people will know who these people are. And for some reason they think that nobody's interested in reading anything that they don't already know. And I think I read
Which
things,
is kind of stupid, isn't it?
It is kind of stupid. I tried for years to get a book published on John Farrow, who I consider to be the most interesting person who ever worked in Hollywood ever. This is a fascinating
From what I know about
guy.
Him, very interesting.
And everybody would say, don't know who he is.
Yeah.
I said, well, just his wife and daughters, you know, that's something about who he was. But in addition to that, a fascinating life. It's sex, drugs, and rock and roll. It's everything that you want out of a biography. And it's an interesting story. You know, if you just made up a novel, nobody would know who it was. So just treat it like that. But they don't ever look at it.
Well, of course, as you know, the book business is tough now.
Yeah.
I mean,
it's
just really, really
it's changing.
Really tough. So,
and that's why we do podcasts. So,
good. Well, I'm glad you're doing them, and
that's why we end podcasts because I don't want to make you faint from exhaustion from this one. So this has been a real pleasure for me. We've been trying to set this up for a while, but yep. You know how much I like talking to you, and you know how much I admire you. I've known you for first met in 1979 when I first made the trek out to Hollywood, and I've been a thorn in your flesh ever since. So
it's been a pleasure, Frank.
I appreciate it very much.
You're a great guy, and I love all the work that you do, and you know, I'm really happy that I know you.
Well, thank you very much, Bill, and we'll do part two very soon, okay?
Okay.
I hope you enjoyed my talk with Bill Wellman Jr. I always have fun talking with him, and as you've heard, we've known each other for a long, 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 long time and have talked many times, but this is the first time with a microphone, and I was happy to do that. Look for also for Bill in my upcoming documentary, The Lost Remake of Beaugest. He appears for only mere seconds, but it's a good few seconds, and I've got other good guests in it, Leonard Maltin, Kevin Brownlow, Maria Cooper Janis, the daughter of Gary Cooper, as well as three of the guys who were in the film that the documentary is about, The Lost Remake of Beaugest. So that's going to be coming out soon. I hope to have some solid news on the release of that in the very near future. But Bill is in it, and glad to have him there. I will have a lot of his DVDs and the link to the book that is already out, William Wellman, A Man in His Wings, on his page on the website, thecommentarytrack.com. So I hope you will visit there. Hope you will buy the book, buy the DVDs, and I'll get a little bit of kickback if you go through the Amazon links on my page. I'll get a little bit of kickback, and that'll be nice. I want to thank, of course, my wonderful wife, Claire McCullough Thompson, for being my announcer. I want to thank James Hutchins for designing the websites, thecommentarytrack.com, and my personal website, frankthompson.tv. Visit them both. Buy books, buy videos, or just read all about me. And you'll read through and you'll think, what? He wrote a book about the Alamo and he was on the writing staff of The Bachelor? Yes. So many more surprises like that to come. Thanks also, of course, to the great Rob Clearfield and Gary Rand, my old friend, who wrote the music for the podcast. The theme music is one of the real treats of this thing, I believe. And I'm delighted that they contributed that. And I want to thank them every week for the lovely, lovely music. Next week, we'll have documentary filmmaker Harrison Engel, another guy I've admired for a long time and have known for some time. Also a really interesting man. And we'll talk about his fascinating work and his own films that he's made and other films that he's been a part of. So that's going to be a good one coming up next week. So thanks for listening. I'm really grateful. And once again, let me urge you to go to iTunes and leave a good response and five-star review, if you will. And in the meantime, don't you worry. We're going to fix it in post.